Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Willie Brown's long career in politics has been as unlikely as it has been remarkable. Although he is indelibly associated with urban San Francisco, Brown was born in segregated Mineola, Texas, raised by a tough-talking grandmother who ran a speakeasy, and expected to earn money for school clothes by picking beans and shining shoes. His introduction to politics came in 1961, when he organized San Francisco's first-ever sit-in to demand equitable housing laws. 3 years later, this young African-American lawyer won a seat in the California Assembly representing a district made up mostly of working-class white voters. He went on to be the first black speaker of the Assembly and to hold on to that hotly contested post for a record 14 years before resigning to run for mayor of San Francisco against an incumbent opponent. Willie Brown's two terms as San Francisco mayor ended in 2004, but he remains, as he has been for decades, a nationally prominent figure in the Democratic Party, even though he has never served an office outside the state of California. Brown's new memoir is called Basic Brown, My Life and Our Times. He's in town to address the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth tonight at 6 at the downtown Dallas Public Library, and we are delighted to have him here in the KERA studios. Mayor Brown, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. And your last name is Boyd?
It is.
That is my mother's married name.
Well, that's a good name.
Yes.
So from the beginning of your career, you sort of bucked the notion that because you were black, you would be mostly a representative of black constituents. At what point did you realize that that assumption would be made for you by other people?
Well, it was kind of an interesting option, because in the particular district where I sought a job as a member of the legislature, it just so happens that there were fewer than 10% black people. So I really didn't have much of an option, except it's amazing how even black people assume you're a specialist on black issues, but non-black people assume you're equally as much of a specialist. And in both categories, you represent, if you can parlay that, that represents a great strength. And then if you add to that that you're equally competent on non-black issues and on issues that affect the lives of old people, as was the case in San Francisco, working-class people, as was the case in San Francisco, you become instantly not subject to the limitations of race.
Is there, for most other politicians, a color barrier in American politics?
I think that the Obama campaign is altering that. I think in the past there has been a color barrier to politics. Very few African Americans were able to have constituencies that didn't have at least 35% to 40% African Americans. That was just a reality, because that was still the residual discrimination that exists. I kind of assumed that that would continue for longer periods of time than it appears to have continued. In the state of Tennessee, in the last series of elections involving the U.S. Senate, Harold Ford Jr. was a candidate. He was 13 points or thereabouts ahead 5 days before the election, with nothing in the world occurring between that time of measurement and when the vote was actually cast. He lost by 6% to a man who had been indicted in the meantime. And so I thought, oh my God, the discriminatory factor, as I call it, the Bradley factor, named after the mayor of Los Angeles who was about to be elected governor of California, but the Bradley factor, i.e. the residual racism and discrimination, was there. I thought it was still there, but Obama is making a believer out of me that, in fact, you can totally overcome, as I did in limited San Francisco. It looks like you can overcome that same handicap in the nation.
Do you think if there were a President Obama, people would say, yes, this really does force us to reexamine what race means in this country? Or would they say he, like Willie Brown, is sort of an exception to the rule?
They would start with he is an exception to the rule. However, in his capacity as president, if it so happens, then he must reach back and find really talented African Americans who can fill the slots. Mr. Bush did exactly that when he reached out and grabbed Colin Powell, first African American to be Secretary of State. And then he went to a second African American in Condoleezza Rice. He has done a number of choices of African Americans in some other key positions, none, however, as significant as those two. If Mr. Obama is the president, he'll have a chance in his capacity as an African-American president to make, I hope, institutional changes in that regard.
You've said about Condoleezza Rice, she disappointed you in having turned into what you call a country club black person. What does that mean?
Well, when you are in a position of importance and you are also African-American, as I indicated at the outset, you really do have to carry the ball and you have to carry the banner, because the level of discrimination still exists in this nation, and you have got to be prepared to recognize that reality and execute based on that reality. How do you execute? You make sure you do diversity in your own sphere of operation. You make sure that you get African Americans and you get women and you bring them in, you get Hispanics, and you do it deliberately. You don't apologize for it and what have you. If you just simply say, I've been elected and now I'm going to select from just anybody without looking in special places for specially talented people. I'm not suggesting that the talent should be any less than what it would be if the general pool was there. But you have to look in special places to find that talent. You're going to find, because of the nature of how we associate with people, you're going to find too many African Americans playing golf, for an example. But you're going to find a lot of talented people playing golf. There are African Americans in those positions of influence, just as expertise exist in that world, it exists in the black world. You got to go to the black world to find it.
Let's talk about the question of worlds. You've written that you were able to move as comfortably within the white world as within the black world. And I'm wondering at what point you think America will be a place where those two worlds are indistinguishable from each other.
They have become indistinguishable, but only on a limited basis. I'd suggest to you that in the world of golf, I don't think anybody would tell you that Tiger Woods hasn't become just a golfer, a superior golfer. But you look at the rest of the PGA Tour, and you don't see any other black people. Tiger Woods moves comfortably among all of his fellow professional golfers. There are other individuals in the world of music. A fellow that was incredible, Quincy Jones, moved in the world of music between radio and television and movies, and he was sought after not because he was black, but because he was so extraordinarily talented, and he moved in that world. But it didn't make any institutional changes. There's still the limitations imposed on a basis of color.
Mm-hmm. So for an African-American to really move as comfortably in both worlds, he or she has to be at the very top of their profession?
Top of their game, and they literally have to be perceived as at the top of their game. Obama is in that category. As a matter of fact, he may be beyond that category, because I think people see in Obama, they see quality first and color second.
What about someone like Bill Clinton? Maya Angelou said he was the first black president. Did he move equally comfortably, do you think, in the black world and the white world? Does he now?
I think he did until he ran into Obama. And then all of a sudden, even Bill Clinton didn't fully understand how much race pride drives ordinary black people to hero worship when some black is making the step or beyond where blacks ordinarily go. Certainly the Clintons, above all other white politicians, have had the benefit of, the support of, as many black persons in their candidacies as any black has ever had. But then again, they've never been up against a black candidate who can generate that hero worship among blacks. Obama does it with no effort at all. And suddenly the Clintons are really frustrated and exasperated that this base that they so comfortably felt with and had been so much a part of and had done so much with, that suddenly that base, when they find one of their own about to make history, that base shifts to that person strictly on the basis of race, not on the basis of anything else but race. That's confusing even to magnificent people like the Clintons.
So it came up in the introduction. Not a lot of people know this offhand. You are a Texan by birth. You grew up in Mineola, which is about 80 miles from here.
80 miles southeast of here. I grew up there, and I graduated from high school. Mineola Colored High there.
Is there any Texas left in you?
I think there's lots of Texas left in me. I think I brag like I'm still a Texan. I think sometimes I drop my ings like I still live here in Texas, and I certainly will support the Cowboys in any contest except against the Niners.
And yet you got out as soon as you could. At the time, Mineola was intolerant and intolerable in a lot of ways for you. Can you talk about what made you choose San Francisco?
I didn't choose San Francisco. That was not I didn't choose anywhere. I was graduated from high school on like May 17th, 1951 in Mineola, and I was off to Prairie View A&M down in Hempstead, Texas, with a scholarship. I think the scholarship was like $9 a month or something. And you ate at a table where it was like you were family. But I was at a table with 7 football players, 8 people per table. When the food plate got to me being passed around, there was nothing in it. And I noticed that was happening to some other tables. People like myself, not being an athlete or not there on an athletic scholarship, we were being, I thought, dealt out. And I started organizing protests and things like that. And pretty soon, I was persona non grata. And my mother finally yielded and allowed me to work for the remainder of the summer at Founders Library here at SMU. And then my uncle, Itzy, who lived in San Francisco, won the negotiations for the rights for my...
To Willie Brown.
That's right. And I went off to San Francisco to live with my Uncle Itzy to go to college. But I had instructions. First thing you do is join church.
Mm-hmm.
Period. And that's what I did.
I want to talk about your mother and your grandmother. From what you've written, your mother was someone who believed in following the rules so that no one could come along and say, don't do this, you're out of line. She might want to change things as they were, but she worked within the system. Your grandmother, and I think I'm quoting this, you said she didn't take nothing off nobody.
That's right.
So I have to wonder where you feel like you landed on the continuum between the two of them.
I think that's exactly where I landed. I fell right in the crack between the two of them because my grandmother was a tough old bird. I mean, she took no prisoners. She really absolutely believed she could make the law herself. She ran a bootlegging operation using her sons as the drivers because Wood County was dry. She ran this honky-tonk, or this joint called the Shack, up the street in which traveling bands played, and she sold some of everything. I think she had some arrangements, too, with the local high sheriff because the high sheriff was kind of the center of government and controlled everything. But for some reason, you know, when there was rationing of washing powder and rationing of butter and rationing of sugar, my grandmother's basement had all that stuff in it, subject to being distributed to white people and black people for a fee as well. So she had a lot of stuff going. She never got busted. Of course not. She didn't get busted. And then my mother, of course, was a pristine only girl in the family of 5 children by my mother, 4 boys, my grandmother, 4 boys and 1 girl. She was the youngest, and she was like their little queen, and they took care of her, and she grew up obviously being obedient to everything connected with the rules, and she required her children to do essentially the same, except she went off to Dallas to work in somebody's kitchen, and she stayed in what she called in service most of the week, and she'd come home on weekends. Well, the grandmother had charge of the children during that period of time, and so her culture was what was imposed upon us for 5 days and my mother's for 2.
Former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown is with us. He's also the longest-running Speaker of the California Assembly. His new book is called Basic Brown, My Life in Our Times. You can join our conversation today by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a critical, cultural, and timeless education that puts life into perspective. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest today is Willie Brown. He is the former mayor of San Francisco and former speaker of the California State Assembly. His new book is called Basic Brown, My Life in Our Times. And he's in town for an address tonight at 6 at the Downtown Public Library for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. And you can find information about that on our webpage, the think page of KERA.org. If you'd like to join our conversation today, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. So you have said that the real power in politics lies in saying no. What does that mean?
The easiest thing in the world to do is to say yes, because everybody's asking for something. When you say no, you actually have to evaluate and determine, hopefully, that it's not in the best public interest. And then to sell what's in the best public interest becomes difficult. Many times it's along the roots of no.
So when you make a promise, I know you don't make them easily, but when you make one, you won't break it?
I try not to break any promise. I try, however, to make sure that before I make a promise, it's an informed promise. It's an informed commitment. And that's why when most people deal with me, they leave the room. They're not sure what I said or how I said it, because I have deliberately made sure that I have a sufficient amount of flexibility to ultimately make a quality decision rather than the decision based upon only a minor understanding or a preference understanding of the issue.
That sounds like plausible deniability, the kind of thing that people hate about politicians.
Well, they can hate it if they wish, but let me tell you, you're better off, believe me, if a politician struggles to find and get all of the information, makes himself or herself available for input from everybody, and then makes a decision and announces that decision with all the supporting reasons why the decision has been made.
You had a nickname for yourself when you were Speaker of the State Assembly, the Ayatollah.
I didn't. I said that. That's one of those bad quotes.
Do you wish you'd never said it?
Let me tell you. Half of the time when I say things, it's for that immediate purpose and that purpose only, and it's to evoke the response, and usually humorously. And I was at a high school in San Francisco, George Washington High School, and I was bantering back and forth with the kids. And in Newsweek magazine, there had just been a major story about the awesome, all-encompassing power of the Ayatollah in the Middle East, in Iran. And one of these kids started asking me and peppering me questions about how much power the speaker really had. And I said, the speaker's like an Ayatollah, all power. And some reporter in there wrote down that I was calling myself the Ayatollah, and that stuck. And I don't bother to, you know, deny or try to change anybody's mind about what they say.
How important was it to you to have a great deal of power as speaker?
It was the only way I would keep the job. I wouldn't want the job. I don't like just the title. I like what the title brings with it, which is the authority to be productive, in every category. It's the authority to be the mediator of disputes between various interests. It's the authority to leverage the governor and the state senate into doing what is the correct thing to do on whatever issue. It's the authority to help elect people. It's the authority to do a sea change course in politics in California and in public policy. I wouldn't want the job if it didn't have that kind of power.
Your critics say some of that amounted to amassing power for its own sake.
Well, you don't amass power for its own sake. You amass power to use it to be productive. And believe me, you survive on the basis of your productivity. You do not survive just on the basis of accumulated power, period.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest is Mayor Willie Brown, former mayor of San Francisco and speaker of the California State Assembly for 14 years. His new book is called Basic Brown, My Life and Our Times. Let's talk to Hal in Fort Worth. Hi, Hal.
Hello.
Hi.
Yes, I have a question. I'm a white male at 70 years old, and I pick cotton with all races of people. But today, when I befriend black people or they befriend me, I've wondered how far that trust goes, that we can really be honest with it. I wondered about that a lot.
Hal, before I get an answer for you, how much do you trust your black friends?
Well, I think I want to trust them, you know, all the way. But I've wondered about that, you know. I mean, when you befriend someone, I've often wondered, do they really believe I'm trying to be a friend or something like that, and vice versa.
Hal, I don't think trust has any limits as it relates to race. I think that people earn trust based on their performance and their willingness to extend trust, period. And again, it has nothing to do with whether or not you're black or white. In the world of politics, you got to know that trusting is and reliability and loyalty are the cornerstones. I lost the speakership in 1974, and who do you think double-crossed me? A man I trusted, a black man, a fellow that was like my roommate. He was scheduled to nominate me, and he got a better offer from the other side. He didn't get any offer from me, but he got a better offer from the other side. He got offered a position which he could never have gotten from me because I didn't think he was qualified for it, and I still didn't think he was qualified for it. And he proved not to be qualified for it because he couldn't do it well enough to hold on to it once it was given to him. But he double-crossed me without notice, and it was a black man who double-crossed me. So trust is not a issue that is racially identifiable. It is an issue that is a human quality that is identifiable.
In 1980, when you did become Speaker, you had more Republicans voting for you than Democrats. How did you work that?
Well, from 1974 on, I was kind of in the doghouse, but I worked my way out of the doghouse. And as I was working my way out of the doghouse, I found in the doghouse lots of Republicans. As a matter of fact, all of the Republicans, and nobody was being decent to them. I commenced to be very decent and treated every Republican as you should treat every member. Once you are elected, you're no longer Republicans or Democrats. And I befriended lots of Republicans. They befriended me. And when it was an opportunity to include them in the selection process for the speakership, it was a no-brainer. My Democratic opponent wouldn't even think of talking to a Republican. I simply had one conversation with one Republican, a woman named Carol Hallett. She put the rest of it together with a friend, a staff guy named Ed Rollins. And overnight, I had 28 Republican votes out of 32, and I had 23 Democratic votes out of 47 or 48. And it was just astounding to people that somebody could put together 41 votes. In this case, it became 51 by doing a Republican-Democrat coalition.
Do you think partisan politics, as it's practiced in America today, is ultimately bad for the people of America?
Very bad, because it reduces itself to one party allegedly having the formula for success and the formula for solutions to problems, which that's not a reality. There are constituencies that are made up of Republicans, Democrats, Green Party, every other kind of party there is, independents. There are even constituencies that contain people like Ralph Nader. And they are entitled to equal representation on the public policy decision-making once you're out of the campaign. We've gotten away from that. I think since about 1994, when Newt Gingrich came along and introduced the harsh partisanship, and it's been continuously practiced till 2008. And in some cases, it's still being practiced. I think the Obama campaign clearly evidences a desire for people to move away from that, or at least that's what he's preaching. Arnold Schwarzenegger in California preached the same thing and became successful at getting reelected on that basis. Bloomberg in New York is preaching the same thing and is trying desperately to make sure that he has an impact on the national picture in that regard. So there are some people making an effort to get away from this harsh partisanship. Harshness in the world of partisanship and the way in which his practice impedes the opportunity for successful public policymaking.
People in California were astounded when you publicly supported Arnold Schwarzenegger for governor. Did you, you guys have been friends for years, I know, but did you ever give that a moment's thought and think this might devalue my position as a Democrat?
Well, most of the decisions that I've made in the world of politics have always been what's in the best public interest, and I've been able to sell it as being in the best public interest. I've never thought about how it affected me personally because, one, obviously I've never wanted to run for anything other than the limited jobs that I ultimately acquired. And number two, I've never wanted to be party chair of any political party, period. And number three, I seldom, if ever, assume a leadership role in a partisan situation, whether a sub or a major. And so consequently, worrying about how I would be viewed by Democrats was not of major concern for me.
Of course, apologists on both sides of the aisle for really hyper-partisan politics will say, maybe it's ugly, maybe it's, we don't like it, but this is the way you get power, the kind of power that you were talking about earlier, that you want it to be able to exercise it, to be able to use it to get your job done.
Well, in the world of politics, you got to know that you don't belong there unless you really understand that in some cases you have to make some really tough decisions. For an example, a decision about who will head your party, that could be a very tough decision because it might be some chummy friend of yours who doesn't, in your opinion, have the quality to lead, but is insistent out of friendship that you embrace his or her candidacy. And if you intend to make significant changes with that choice, you may have to tell your friend to go jump in the lake. On the other hand, an enemy may be the person that possesses the real qualities to provide the leadership, and you may offend all of your other friends by virtue of the fact of removing your opposition to that enemy, because that enemy might be the best thing for this democracy or for this situation. That's kind of where Arnold Schwarzenegger ended up, and that's why I ended up in part befriending him.
How personal is the whole process for you?
Politics is very personal. As a matter of fact, you succeed a lot more at what you are attempting to do if there is a personal relationship involved in the decision-making. In the book, in Basic Brown, I talk about how we did apartheid, and I talked about how I developed a relationship with the then governor, Republican governor, conservative
governor. State of California was invested.
That's right.
In South Africa.
Correct. Both our university system, as would be the case with the University of Texas at Austin and its endowment funds, as well as the state pension fund, which is the largest pension fund in the world. And they were investing in companies doing business in South Africa. This Republican governor led the effort by the Board of Regents to undo that. This Republican governor, Duke Majan, also signed the bill that would cause a divestment by the pension fund. And that was initiated by a personal relationship between two men, George Duke Majan and Willie Brown.
Willie Brown is my guest. His new book is called Basic Brown, My Life and Our Times. You can join us today by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can call 1-800-933-5372. We've talked a lot about Barack Obama this hour, but you have not made an endorsement, is that correct?
No, I have not endorsed. And it just so happens that Hillary Clinton is a very good personal friend. And believe me, as significant as the Obama phenomenon happens to be, and by the way, I'm not sure that one could honestly say that the Obama movement is a political party operation. It really isn't. It's something beyond that.
Something
it doesn't,
social?
I'm not sure exactly what it is, but it's almost like it's something more inspirational and spiritual than it is political. Some of these people who are involved have never been involved before. They don't even fully know the agenda and the program for public policy making purposes, but they're so carried away with the charismatic leader that they are signing on and donating like nobody else. You don't get that in the pure world of politics. People in politics usually have a definition of who you are. They have an idea of what you're about. They kind of know the program, whether it's education, whether it's health care, whether it's employee rights, whether it's discrimination, whether it's gay and lesbian rights. They know something, same-sex marriage. They know something about you that causes them. They don't know anything about Barack Obama in that regard. They really are carried away with his demand for change, his being the tool of change, his being the inspirational leader for a new day, and his rejecting all the old ways. And they are fascinated with that. On the other hand, Hillary Clinton is probably the best prepared candidate since her husband to run for the presidency. She really is steep in social values on a positive nature. When she came out of college, she did with Miss Edelman, the Children's Defense Fund. She's done marvelous work. I first met her in 72 when she was here in Texas operating on behalf of George McGovern in his candidacy for the president in partnership with her then husband, Bill Clinton. She's gone through all of that. She's gone through the trial and tribulations of a wife of a major figure who didn't always show the greatest of disciplines, as evidenced by some of the things he got himself involved in. And she has been in the position where she's been soundly trounced by the healthcare industry when she attempted to bring universal healthcare. She has withstood the test of time in every way. And she's a female. We've never, ever had a female candidacy for the presidency to get even this far in the nominating process. She is at worst, number two in the nominating process. All the males that were there, except Obama, have fallen by the wayside, and she started out as the odds-on favorite to win the whole thing. So this revolutionary change, an African-American inspirational leader who has gone beyond the race designation, and a female who has somehow burst the bubble of the limits of what females can do and is in fact doing it without exploiting the so-called feminist movement. It's incredible what these two people have in fact done in this political contest. And for those of us that are real political junkies, it's like the biggest high you could get.
My guest is former San Francisco mayor and former California State Assembly Speaker Willie Brown. His book is called Basic Brown, My Life in Our Times. He is in town for an address at 6 tonight at the Downtown Dallas Public Library for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find their website at dfwworld.org. To join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a critical, cultural, and timeless education that puts life into perspective. Details online at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former San Francisco Mayor Willie Brown. His new book is called Basic Brown, My Life and Our Times. You can see him in person this evening at 6 at the Downtown Dallas Public Library for an address that he is making for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. If you'd like to join us right now, the telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's speak to Adam in Dallas. Hi, Adam.
Mayor Brown, I was wondering what advice you would give to any young person who wanted to be elected into public office that had no public experience before, what route they should take or how they should become involved?
It's very simple. The most important part of the early entry qualifications, you really must do and complete whatever educational pursuit that you are desirous of. And you must do that at the highest and the most successful level you possibly can. Once you get that credential behind you, then you should identify some subject matter that you care about and align yourself with whatever neighborhood organization, a CBO, or what have you, that's attempting to do something about it. Within the context of that participation, your volunteerism will, I think, demonstrate to the people there that you are worthy of being entrusted with their franchise. And eventually, short order, sometimes longer, they will look to you to begin to provide the leadership. And once people start looking to you for leadership, it will not be long before you can identify some potential elective office that will give you the opportunity to implement those things you care about. And in particular, you will begin, I think, to add to your treasure trove of things you're interested in once you master one.
When it comes to campaign finance, you have been pretty straightforward that you think people should have to report not only every cent they receive and exactly where it comes from, but exactly how it gets spent. Is politics, do you think, inherently more corruptible than any other professional field?
Not at all. Not at all. I think that because of the incredible amount of money that sometimes shows up in politics, and for people who have a greedy streak in them, and most of us probably have some form of a greedy streak in us, sometimes you can get siphoned off by virtue of that, what appears to be free money, so to speak. And so it becomes important, I think, for you to understand how quickly your career could end if you do something untoward with resources that have been given to assist in electing you. And that's why I absolutely do not understand how McCain, Feingold, and all those people can come up with all these bizarre schemes for reporting and caps and limits and then allow all these independent committees to go out there and spend on your behalf, and we have no idea who they are or what they are. I come from the position that people's careers can be terminated if it is in the judgment of the voters that they have done something inappropriate in the acceptance of money as contributions and the expending of that money. In my own state, Alan Cranston, a revered and respected U.S. senator with senior status in the Senate, took a contribution from a guy named Keaton, who was notorious in the SNL industry, and he was one of the five people that took contributions from Mr. Keaton to use for voter registration purposes. The public in California were so disgusted with that dumb decision that Mr. Cranston's career was abruptly ended. That is the way, in my opinion, you best control what happens with receptions of money or the receipt of money and the expenditure of money in the world of politics. And I believe that that is the very best system. And then finally, I really don't like the idea that some jerk who just qualifies barely may be using my tax dollars to get himself elected. I don't want to make a contribution to anybody in my tax dollars that way. And so I reject the idea of public finance.
How do you feel about the idea of candidates reporting everything about their personal lives? You have made it clear in the past that you don't think politicians have an obligation to reveal the personal details of their lives.
They do not. As a matter of fact, when I'm running for the California State Assembly and I'm sworn in, they don't say anything about, well, you know, the Ten Commandments. That's not part of what I swore to do or swore to be. They don't say anything about in a marriage situation, you know, love, honor, and obey, and respect, and be faithful unto for the rest of my life. No, none of that is contained therein. It does say I must do my job, and I must do it with integrity. I must do it with total and complete candor and honesty, and I must do it in the public interest. That doesn't necessarily include developing relationships of love and love relationships that people usually have no real control over. Those are emotional connections that are made. And as long as it doesn't interfere with my discharging the duties to which I've been sworn to do, I don't think it's necessary for me to every day of my life go back and prove my fidelity.
And yet those things take down careers, and it hasn't really happened for you. You've been somewhat open about the fact that you've had relationships outside your relationship with your wife. That's your business, and it's what you want to do. What's different about you that has not made that an issue in your political career?
I think everybody who knows Willie Brown has never seen in one spark of hypocrisy in me. I don't profess to be the person that your son or your daughter may wish to model themselves after, except for my politics and except for my educational pursuit and my achievement. I think you have the responsibility to raise your child in whatever fashion you wish to raise your child, and I should similarly be situated. You should not impose upon me the standards that you have and think that, therefore, if I don't meet those standards, I'm somehow less than you or less than what you expected.
Do you think people are short-sighted when they say, well, it's a character issue? I need to know that you're faithful to your wife or that you treat your kids well or whatever. And that tells me about you as a human being and therefore as a public servant.
You have a right to measure those things, but I don't have an obligation to confess if I choose not to.
Willie Brown is my guest. He's former mayor of San Francisco and the longest-running speaker of the California Assembly. His new book is called Basic Brown, My Life and Our Times. Let's go next to Celeste in Fort Worth. Hi, Celeste.
Yes, this is Celeste. I have a question for Mr. Brown. One of your speakers, earlier speakers, had some concerns about whether the trust between him, a white person, and a black person is profound or deep enough. And I think he has a very good reason to feel that way, such that whenever you say trust is earned, whenever it comes between the two races, it's not always clear-cut like that. Because I don't like every black person that I see, that I meet on the road as well. I do not like every white person that I meet on the way. It's always, people have to connect and to trust each other. But then, you have to understand that in our world today, there are still a lot of white people that are very racist, that are extremely racist. But they cover this up very, very well. A whole lot of black people actually do recognize this. They cover this up very well, and you never, ever know. You're never, ever going to find out unless you catch them when they're not on their guard. Okay, for example, one of my co-workers...
I think we have your point. Let's go ahead and get a response from Mayor Brown. Thanks so much for your call.
I hope you've been listening for the full hour, because I think I cited young Harold Ford Jr. early on in my comment when I was talking about Mr. Obama's chances. I said that the world you thought had rid itself of this so-called racism, but it seemed to have risen its ugly head in the case of Harold Ford Jr., but it doesn't seem to have yet evidenced itself in the Obama situation, and we ought to analyze why not. I share your view. I don't think you ought to make decisions on a basis of who you like or dislike based upon race. I think you ought to make decisions based upon people's conducts and people's presentations to you and how they come off to you. I do think that there are people who have residual views, both black and white, about folk that they just visibly see, and they bring to bear all of their experiences, etc., as they look at that person. But in one interchange, you ought to be able to get rid of those phobias and move on beyond it. And I don't think it's based and has its foundation necessarily in race. And so I think it's probably not helpful to conclude that white people are just racist. I don't think that that's something you ought to impose upon the entire white world.
On a somewhat related note, you do assume that people might judge you and who you are and what you mean according to how you dress yourself. That's something
that's very much so.
Well known for. Let's talk about what you have on today.
Very much so. Well, I have on a gray suit. Mm-hmm. I have on a white shirt. And I have on a red tie with small blue figurines in it.
And getting dressed this morning, you thought what?
I thought that I was going to be interviewed by you, Chris. I was going to be interviewed by several other people. I was going to be on radio for an interview, but not seen necessarily. I'm doing a luncheon today, and I'm doing an event tonight. And so I had to dress literally so that I could go through the whole day. Gray, muted gray, with a white shirt, and this particular tie gets me through that. Otherwise, I'd have to change.
You've
sometimes during the course of the day.
Four times a day sometimes.
Oh, yeah. Right. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I'm a little bit of a nut about this. Let's get it straight. My standard and my conduct is not that of a normal human being as it relates to clothing. I do say, however, that it is highly appropriate to pay some attention to what you wear. Coming from Mineola, Texas, I remember very clearly that I had clothes I could only wear to church on Sunday. I had shoes that I could only wear on Sunday. I also, on reflection, watched the Academy Awards the other night, Sunday night, and the reports were focused on what people were wearing. They didn't say how they acted or what have you. They were checking out the dresses. Unfortunately, there was gender discrimination because they didn't focus on some of those horrible tuxedos. I'm telling you, some of those guys look terrible. But they have not yet gotten to the point where they focus on tuxedos. They do go, and the women must have spent a fortune trying their best to have the right jewelry, the right hairdo, and the right dress for whatever their figure happens to be. And then finally, when the awards were given, there was an award given for acting, there was an award given for direction, there was an award given for writing, and there was an award given for wardrobe. So it is clear that in that artistic world, wardrobe plays a role. And believe me, in the world of politics, wardrobe plays a role.
Do you have to censor yourself from judging other people according to how they look?
No. You mean how they're dressed?
How they're dressed.
You know, I'll let you know if you're tacky. I can't help it. I usually will say. And one of the great things about being Speaker of the California State Assembly is that I literally, almost single-handedly, changed the nature of the wearing apparel on the floor. I had people coming to me on a daily basis for approval. Is this tie all right? I even took guys shopping. The ones who were really tacky, I took them shopping because we were broadcasting and telecasting, and I didn't want bizarre-looking costumes being projected the image of my house.
That's not micromanagement?
It probably is. But I told you that I'm a little bit more of a abnormal individual in that regard as it relates to clothing.
Willie Brown is my guest. We have time for one more call. Let's go to Kent in Weatherford. Hi, Kent.
Hi. I just want to thank Willie Brown for his service in California. I know he's done a lot of great work, but I was kind of dazed and confused that after his beautiful description of Hillary Clinton personally and politically, that he hasn't endorsed anybody yet.
Well, I broadcast in California. As a matter of fact, I'm going back because I'm on at 6:40 tomorrow morning on television, and I do some analyst work occasionally on MSNBC in the Situation Room with Wolf and those persons, and it seems to be more comfortable for the network if the individual who's doing the analysis isn't trying to push one or the other person, and you kind of have to demonstrate that you're not doing that. So I've been equally as critical of Mr. Obama and Mrs. Clinton. I've been equally as praiseworthy where it has been warranted. And believe me, suddenly, nationwide, I'm viewed kind of as a fresh air person. And by the way, I'm enjoying it because I still have friends with everybody.
You were not available for a cabinet position the last time a Democrat was president. If a Democrat is president in this next election, after this next election, is that something that you would aspire to?
I don't think, no, not at all. There are really incredibly talented people of color in particular, and women, and they are younger. They have a lot more time left on their public service agenda, and I would like to just remain part of the network. And the network is how I met Obama. It was 2004 when one of the network guys out of Atlanta called me to tell me about this Barack Obama running for the U.S. Senate in Illinois, and that I should help him. That network can find quality people to be cabinet-level people.
Willie Brown's new memoir is called Basic Brown, My Life and Our Times. He's in town at the invitation of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth. You can find more about his appearance tonight at dfwworld.org. Mayor Brown, thanks so much for joining us.
Chris, thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.